Morning, we're delighted to welcome you all, but we welcome especially the Monticello High School students. Would they please stand?
Come on.
Very shy.
Don't be shy. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Pius XI High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You're welcome too. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the state court and by the Wisconsin Bar Association. Students from across the state are invited to come and hear an oral argument. And if they come, they have been given the briefs of the case we are about to hear. They may have engaged in outside activities relating to this case. And they then come. And as part of the program, they will meet with a justice of this court after the second oral argument. The discussion will be as to the procedure of the court, not the substance of the cases that we have heard this morning. Everyone is invited to the session with the justice. It is not limited to the students. So we will now introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you will meet after the second case. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left is Justice Patience Robensack. And to the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will now call the first case today, Seacoakley Relocation Systems versus City of Madison. Representing Seacoakley Relocation Systems is Attorney Donald Mern. Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel. I would like, before beginning a brief recitation of the facts, bring to the court's attention that in my preparation in this matter, I believe it is important to deviate slightly from my brief and take a very pointed position with regard to the statute of limitations issue, and I want to make that statement before I begin my argument. I think the question of 3220 and when the statute of limitations runs is when the writ of assistance is perfected. I do not think that issue is left open. I think in order for this court to make a proper decision, that issue needs to be very pointed, and therefore I take the position that the statute has not run and has not run until the City of Milwaukee properly perfects the writ of assistance.
Well, but you're out.
Pardon me?
Your client has been out of that property since October 14th.
Correct.
I'm sorry. That's right. October 14th, 2002. What are you saying, that they won that assistance, that maybe it was wrong because Coakley is a displaced person, but now they're out and you want the city to bring another writ of assistance? Is that what you're saying?
I believe that they should correct the writ of assistance either substantially through offering a comparable replacement property and relocation benefits, or by going back to court and correcting the writ.
How do you correct the writ? Your client moved. There's no correction.
Yes, because the writ was obtained improperly and was reversed. The fact that...
Does your client want to go back on the property? Can it go back on the property?
Well, if I wanted to make that statement out front because I think it will make my argument more coherent, Chief Justice.
Well, it makes it, you are trying to make it persuasive that the 2 years doesn't run from October 14, 2002.
Correct. I think otherwise, if I make an argument that, If I don't make that statement in preparing for argument, I believe it leaves this court in a decision of trying to guess as to when the statute of limitations runs.
So when did the statute of limitations start to run, in your opinion? Hasn't it started yet?
I do not believe it has started.
That's what I thought you'd say. Okay.
Now, the facts that I think, I want to briefly recite the facts just to bring the court back up to speed as to this case. As the court, I'm sure, remembers, my client leased a parking lot from Roadmaster. They disputed that they were not a displaced person under Section 32.19 sub 2E or a tenant occupant under Wisconsin Administrative Code 202 sub 0.01 sub 4. They disputed this going forward throughout this case. They were never offered relocation benefits. They refused to leave. On October 14th of 2002, Circuit Court in Milwaukee, Judge Gooley issued a writ of assistance. Pursuant to that writ of assistance, my client moved off the property, not voluntarily, but pursuant to the writ. On 5-13-03 in the Roadmaster case, the writ was found to be void and the case was remanded. At that point, Coakley entered into negotiations with the city, and at some point those negotiations broke down. Trial counsel brought several causes of action that were dismissed by Judge Franke and various motions, which led to the appeal, the Coakley appeal, which the appellate court found that for various reasons, two of which I'll focus in on that I think are most important and dispositive for this appeal before this court, but ultimately found in favor of the trial court's decision and upheld it. I believe that there's two main issues that this court needs to deal with and are dispositive of the issues with regard to Coakley. One, what is the effect of the improper writ that was gained by the city? And two, are Coakley's claims therefore barred by Section 3220, the two-year statute of limitations? The writ that the city gained under Section 3205 sub 8 required the city by necessity, jump through a number of hoops in order for them to gain the writ. One of them was to offer relocation benefits and assistance to a displaced person. That's clear under the statute. They did not do so, and when they gained the writ. There is an intimation.
Counsel, just so I can follow your argument, let's assume for sake of this question that the writ shouldn't have been issued. And let's assume for purposes of the question that the statute of limitations hasn't run. Just what is it that you are asking for in this case? What type of damages or type of response are you entitled to? Just so I can, because it seems to me that you can't go back on the property, so exactly what is it that you're requesting?
Relocation benefits.
All right, so relocation benefits.
Correct.
Anything else?
No. I think we are entitled to the statutory relocation benefits and assistance. I believe that's our relief.
And that's $30,000.
And we are entitled to presentation of comparable replacement property. We were never presented with comparable replacement property. Not the purchase of it for our benefit, not money to buy it, but the presentation of comparable replacement property.
All right, and the reason I'm pressing you is just what does that mean in the context of this case? You're already off the premises. Are you looking for another location to move to, or have you already moved?
My clients are still doing business on that site. They need parking.
Got it.
That parking has disrupted their business. It's making them more costly to do business at their site. They need parking.
So you're looking for $30,000 and a place to park?
$30,000 or a place to park. If we can get comparable replacement property, that if we would have been presented with alternatives, for instance, most of these cases, Dottie Dumpling, Midwest CC2, Janesville versus Midwest CC2, not so much Basinger because that was, although started the principle, isn't the same. But on all those, the displaced person was provided a comparable replacement property. They didn't like it. They said, we can't afford it, we don't like where it is, it's not going to allow us to operate the way we want. But they were provided it before the writ was given. My clients, Coakley, was never provided a comparable replacement property. They didn't have the opportunity to go and look at parcels and say, yes, we like it, no, we don't like it, it works for us, it doesn't. totally different basis than this case that's before this court here today.
Yeah. Okay.
Again, it's undisputed that they never did offer us that comparable replacement property. And really the key issue then is what effect does the Roadmaster case have when an improper writ was issued, and who should bear the burden from the standpoint of when a condemnor displaces a tenant in possession and improperly identifies or fails to identify a displaced person. The intimation at some point is that this is somehow a constitutional issue. I do not believe it is. I think it's strictly statutory. I think this court's majority opinion in Midwest CC2 to me is a very good recitation of the facts of what the legislature set forth in relocation benefits and how the legislature looks at and opined as to why relocation benefits were important and why they were set forth with particularity. I think that the writ of assistance, section 3205 sub 8, has to be read in conjunction with section 3220 in order to give them both effect. I do not believe that the section 3205 sub 8 is simply an occupancy section devoid of or removed from the benefits section. I don't understand why the legislature would have put in specifics regarding what needed to be done before a writ of assistance could be issued if it wanted to basically disjoint or remove the necessity of benefits being given to a displaced person. Unlike the other case laws I mentioned in my discussion with Justice Butler, we never were made available a replacement property. These other cases...
Isn't that because the city never thought you were a displaced person? So they didn't bargain with you as though you had those statutory rights. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. We were never bargained with. And to me, that is the crux of the real problem that I have with this particular case. I think in looking at Coakley, and again, in dissecting some of the things that went on, one of the big problems that I had in looking at it from an appellate standpoint is, why didn't Coakley just make a claim at a certain point? Aren't we just coming here and asking you, well, help out Coakley? This doesn't have any gravity on a grand scale. But I disagree, because the problem I see with this case is, if the writ is given no effect, in other words, if the only issue here is that physical possession is the trigger for the two-year statute to run for claims, and therefore the writ really doesn't have any effect. In other words, a municipality can go in, make a mistake as far as definition of as to displaced person, get their writ. The two-year statute runs because they enter into physical possession with an improper writ. An appellate court properly determines that the displaced person should have been given relocation benefits, voids the writ, and the municipality says, oh, we made a mistake. We're in possession. Your 2 years ran. You don't get anything.
Now, your client never challenged the writ. They challenged whether they were displaced. They challenged whether they are entitled to money. But they never challenged the writ as such. They never challenged that they should get out of possession as such. I mean, that's what the Court of Appeals said, and that's what appears to have been said in the trial court. If you agreed that you hadn't challenged the writ. You could have challenged the writ, couldn't you? Couldn't you seek an injunction? Oh. Couldn't you have gone in and fought the writ?
I don't see what the basis of we'd have to have gone in and stated that we would have been irreparably harmed. In other words, being taken out of possession, that we would have no other relief.
The reason you think the writ was no good is that the issuance depended on your not being a displaced person. Didn't the writ have something to do with whether or not you were a displaced person?
Correct.
Okay. And so they issued the writ. You're saying the writ is bad because you are a displaced person and the city thought you were not. But you didn't fight on that ground against the writ.
But I believe... No, but I believe, Chief Justice, that if we would have, we would have to have gone in, and the basis for fighting the writ would be that we want injunctive relief. Please remove this order, putting them in legal possession.
Right.
And as a basis of that, we would have irreparable harm if you allow this to proceed forward. But I believe the court at that point, through analysis, would have said, well, Coakley, what do you want? We want our relocation benefits. Well, then how are you irreparably harmed? I can order that if you're correct.
Counsel, then how does City of Milwaukee versus Roadster LLC, how does that play into this? Because there it does seem that the lessee appealed. The court held that the lessee was a displaced person for purposes of eminent domain, and the city was required to make available comparable replacement property before the writ could be ordered. Then you went through and you dismissed that case. So how does that case factor into the argument you're making now?
I believe that the Roadster case required the city to correct their writ. That case was dismissed without prejudice, and Coakley brought a cause of action asking for relocation benefits. So I believe that the Roadster case, without the city never offered, and to this date has never offered, comparable replacement property. If their writ was obtained improperly, and the statute has not yet run, we still have the right to relocation benefits.
Counsel, you're confusing me a bit with your argument. It seems to me, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, that you're kind of equating relocation benefits with comparable replacement property. And as I see the statutes, I see two different things. You have a comparable replacement property, which is something that has to be provided in advance prior to the granting of a writ of assistance. And then you have the concept of relocation benefits, where when a party moves, they're entitled to a certain statutory sum to assist in the moving to the new location. I don't see one as being equal to the other. Am I reading the statute wrong, or is that your argument? Am I misunderstanding you?
I don't think you're misreading it wrong. What I am trying to do is get Coakley back to a point where they are entitled to all those benefits. And since the city has argued the statute's run and you're not entitled to any of those benefits, I'm trying to put them back in a position.
But this gets to your argument about irreparable harm. Your concern was that if you'd gone into court before, that the judge says, well, I can order relocation benefits and that takes care of your harm, but it doesn't really, does it? Because you still have the issue of where do you go? Where's your comparable replacement property? And that's why I see the two things as being, you know, one, you've got to have a place to go, and two, when you go, you're entitled to assistance to move. I don't see them as being the same thing.
Part of the disturbing problem with trying to get back to a point, I think why the legislature set out this particular system and how it was supposed to go was to ensure that a displaced person had the opportunity to assess what relocation benefits they were entitled to, look at the menu, pick what they wanted for their relocation benefits, put an endpoint to it, and move on. Because we were never offered a comparable replacement property to choose from, we did not have the opportunity to say we would like, instead of a comparable replacement property, our $30,000 and our other benefits in terms of those.
I understand that. But my point goes to your argument that if you had been ordered relocation benefits, that would have cured any irreparable harm. If you haven't got a place to go yet, I'm not sure how that cures any harm. You still need a place to go. And so it goes to your issue about whether or not the statute of limitations is run, because they're really talking about two different things here.
It's a good point.
Counsel, could you explain when you challenged the writ of assistance and it went up to the Court of Appeals and then it came down, the case was dismissed. Why was it dismissed and what is the significance of that?
Part of the reason I hesitate is I was not involved in Roadmaster. So I believe that the reason it was dismissed was because there was the parties engaged in, because it was dismissed without prejudice, the parties engaged in negotiations to try to resolve the issues between them. That's my understanding of why it was dismissed without prejudice.
And can you explain why that has no effect on the statute of limitations issue?
Because I believe that the statute does not run until the city corrects the defects in getting the writ. Because the problem that I have, and again, I would like now, because I made in the beginning of my argument the statement that I believe the statute has not run. 3220 says that basically the part I will focus on is when the city enters into physical possession, the statute runs. I believe that physical possession, that what the legislature meant was proper legal physical possession, not just physical possession. And I'd like to draw an analogy. Oftentimes in a condemnation, in this case, a redevelopment, contractors are brought onto site and they begin work on a property. Oftentimes, contractors believe that a municipality has possession of a parcel and they can start work on it. They can take physical possession of a parcel that maybe a municipality does not have a right to be on from a legal standpoint. Does that mean that the physical, is that what the legislature anticipated, that once an agent for a city takes physical possession of a property, the time period starts ticking? Or did the legislature anticipate that a writ of assistance needed to be gotten and legal possession needed to be obtained before the clock started ticking?
Counselor, I think you can get physical possession, as I read the statute, in either two ways. Sometimes people just voluntarily move off the property, and they give up, by their moving voluntarily, possession to the city, which I think would fall under the statute. In your client's case, they refused to move when they were asked to move, and so they moved only by court order. And if I understand your argument, you're saying because that court order was held to be invalid, they really still, the physical possession has not actually transferred under the terms of the statute. Is that what you're saying?
That's my argument. I think it would be, I certainly wouldn't advise a client to ignore a court order, stand with shotgun and pitchfork, and disturb the peace. I think once that writ is issued, they need to get off, and that to me is not a voluntary moving off the property.
Right. Well, the Court of Appeals said that, you know, the way to avoid starting this running of the two-year period was to refuse to get off the property, but I don't think that they had in mind or understood the facts of this case where you were obeying a court order when you got off. I don't think they would be advising clients to ignore court orders. But
the disturbing part of the case for me is, and I think the justices are aware in going back, and I can see by the questions, there's a lot of questions about couldn't this have been done and couldn't that have been done, and certainly in looking back at some of the things that have happened, and not necessarily point fingers of how it could have been done properly, but the disturbing point about it is how these statutes interact, what the legislature had in mind, and what could happen in the field to other displaced parties, occupants under the COM rules. As a attorney who represents private individuals in condemnation matters, I have concerns about owner-occupants and what could happen. Condemnations occur to large amounts of people who don't always retain counsel, who don't always have the benefit of counsel, who are familiar with the condemnation area because it's a very narrow part of the law. I think the burden should be on the condemnor, the municipality with the power, to make sure that they're making proper decisions with regard to who is and is not a displaced person, who is and is not entitled to relocation benefits, as opposed to the condemnee and putting it the burden on them to assure that a writ of assistance is properly issued, to make sure that they are the ones who are perfecting the legal process to ensure that they get the proper benefits.
Counselor, will you list for me all the things that you think are, quote, relocation benefits under the statute?
Well, I think most of the relocation benefits come really from the COM rules. As far as the statute goes, the one, to me, the linchpin for this one would be the comparable replacement property. But there's also the, if you do not accept the comparable replacement property and purchase it, it would be the $30,000 in lieu thereof. You have fees with regard to moving. If you have extraordinary expenses, fees for transfer fees, issues of that nature, extraordinary moving expenses. Some attorney's fees are allowed, although limited.
There are a number of things, and those are all things that you're calling as a category relocation benefits.
Yes.
Thank you.
Could I ask you, counsel?
Yes, Justice.
On 3220, there's a sentence. All such claims must be filed after the damages upon which they are based have fully materialized, but not later than 2 years after the condemnor takes physical possession of the entire property acquired. Now, doesn't that settle this case, or why doesn't it settle this case?
Because I do not think the physical possession, I do not think the legislature intended physical possession to mean illegal physical possession. I think 3220 has to be read with the writ of assistance statute so that if a displaced person has the right to say, I do not believe you've treated me properly, I do not believe I got all the benefits that I'm entitled to under the statute, and I will not move because of it. The condemnor then has to go into court and say, we have met all the standards under the statute, and we are entitled to be put into possession. And I think that the legislature, although they put physical possession because they wanted to make it clear, did not anticipate this type of a situation. And in fact, it has never been before this court because, as I mentioned earlier, all the other cases dealt with the municipality having given the displaced occupant a list of properties saying, here, take your pick, and the displaced occupant going, don't like it, don't like it, don't like it. We didn't think you did your job. Very different here. We never got the list. They never met a key element of the statute. Therefore, they never came into proper legal physical possession. Although I don't believe the legislature meant physical possession because without legal physical possession, because that would lead to absurd results. As I mentioned, does that mean a contractor could go on? I don't believe municipalities, as I don't believe the city of Milwaukee went out of their way at this point to say, let's just work over Coakley. I don't think they made a decision. I don't believe municipalities do that. But because of the press of schedules, construction, administrative snafus, that you can have a situation where a contractor or party municipality could enter into physical possession, and I don't think without proper legal process, and I do not believe the legislature wanted to bless that and give them the right to toll a statute of limitations with regard to relocation benefits that a displaced person is properly entitled to.
Counselor, I have a question, and it's something that neither party has brought up in their briefs, and it may be because it has absolutely no relevance to this case, but it's bothering me, so I'm going to ask you both about it. Under 893.13, there is a tolling provision. It says tolling a statute's of limitations. It says, and it talks about how matters may be tolled during the course of an appeal. And then it also talks about when the tolling ends. It's 893.13.1 and 893.13.2. And, you know, it may be nobody's talked about it because, as I said, it has nothing to do with this. But if it has anything to do with this, I did on CCAP get the record of the first action, the Roadstar Coakley action, and that was not dismissed until October of 2003. And this action was filed in September. Yeah, I know the red light.
Red light.
You can answer if you can, and it's an unfair question. But this action was filed in September of 2005. And so when I look at when that action stopped, when the appeal was done and it went back down on remand, and then when this action was filed, I had a question about whether this statute had anything to do with perhaps tolling the statute of limitations for the two-year period that we're talking about here. And it may have nothing to do with it, but if you've looked at it and you didn't think it did, let me know, or if you just never considered it.
I never considered it, Justice.
Okay.
I never looked at it. In fact, I looked through what I photocopied
okay.
for my discussion today, and okay. I have various sections 893, and I do not even have that section.
Well, that's
here.
A fair answer.
I apologize.
You might look at it while you're sitting down, but you might note that according to the Coakley Court of Appeals decision, the Roadster decision was May 13th, 2003, not August 13th, 2003.
Well, what I would be looking at would be when the dismissal occurred in circuit court under subsection 1 of 893.13.1, and that was in October of 2005. And I, the dismissal is a matter of public record. It's on CCAP, and that's where I ended up having to find the information. But just think about it. And as I said, maybe it has nothing to do with it, but it was bugging me, so I wanted to ask you about it. Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the court and my brother from the bar. I'm going to give you a quick overview of Chapter 32, the eminent domain laws, because I think at this point it's important to take a little step back and look at Chapter 32, and then I'll tear into the meat of the statute of limitation period and the writ statute. And then afterwards, I will address some counter-arguments to the arguments raised by Mr. Mern. And, of course, Justice, I will answer your question about the tolling statute.
Counsel, if you're going through that, could you also address the notice of claim statute 89380 and the interplay between that and your discussion?
I will, and in fact, that is one of the reasons I'm going to give the overview. We know that statutes are construed according to their plain meaning, and we know, and it's very basic, that the more specific statutes control the general ones. So right off the bat, you don't even get into Chapter 893 at all, because we're solely within the confines of Chapter 32. Now, it's very interesting to note here that not one statute in those statute books are alleged by Coakley to be unconstitutional, and not one statute in those statute books yet, or even in Chapter 32, is alleged to be ambiguous. Given that, they're plain. Given that, they have to be interpreted according to their plain meaning. You can't stretch to find ambiguity where none is alleged and where none, in fact, exists. The subject parcel here is a 22-stall parking lot. It's in downtown Milwaukee. You can take judicial notice of the fact that thousands of employees every day drive their automobiles into downtown Milwaukee and they find a place to park. Now, they have to pay for that place to park, but they find a place to park. And then thousands of employees every day leave downtown Milwaukee on the roads and streets and freeways. This subject parcel, 22-stall parking lot, was owned by Roadster, an entity. Behind the entity was a human, Chris Coakley. The entity Roadster leased 17 of the 22 stalls to its controlled tenant, another entity, Coakley. Really, what all this litigation is about is 17 parking stalls that were leased on a short-term oral month-to-month lease. Chris Coakley is the human behind the landlord entity, and he's the human behind the tenant entity. That's important to keep in mind. On January 30th, 2002, the city, with the enormous power of eminent domain that we do not take lightly whatsoever, because we respect basic freedoms in America, including land ownership, had to use eminent domain to acquire this parcel for the public good, because it was in the public interest, because we needed to do a public project. We needed to extend a street, McKinley Boulevard. The taking was not challenged. On January 30th, 2002, we took and we acquired the parking lot. Now, we're solely within Chapter 32, not within any other chapter of the statutes. But within Chapter 32, there's a constitutional element under the state constitution and the federal constitution, and there's a statutory element that's been recognized, well recognized in Wisconsin case law throughout the years. The constitutional element is taking, the thou shalt not take private property without paying just compensation. There is no constitutional dimension whatsoever in the case being argued before you now. And the reason there is no constitutional element is because there's no challenge. There is no challenge to any of the statutes. There is no challenge to the taking. We validly took under Chapter 32. We validly and legally paid just compensation for the private property.
But that's not what's at issue here. We're not talking about just compensation.
I know that.
We're talking about statutory rights, correct?
I certainly appreciate that, but I'm going to get into the constitutional versus statutory, and you're absolutely right. So constitutional element is not an issue.
Right.
We paid just compensation. Now, the constitutional element comes into the early parts of Section 32.05. Under 32.05.2, government has to obtain an appraisal and turn it over to the landowner. The landowner can get an appraisal. Under sub 2A, government has to negotiate with the landowner. And we have to turn over Department of Commerce prepared pamphlets describing the eminent domain process as a condition, as a precondition to our taking. That's not been questioned. We did that. Under 3205 sub 3, if government cannot reach agreement with the landowner, we can issue what's called a jurisdictional offer. The statute sets forth what has to be in a jurisdictional offer. The proposed date of occupancy by the condemnor has to be in there. The compensation amount, just compensation, that the government is offering to the landowner. Notification to the landowner of the right to challenge the taking. Notification to the landowner that in addition to just compensation, the consideration for the property taken, the landowner or interested parties can claim 32.19 relocation payments under 32.20. And they will be paid, quote, if shown to exist, close quote. Now, the reason I'm going through this is to give you the broad picture, but also to harmonize these statutes, which needs to be done. 32.05 sub 3 sub D is where that quote is from. Now, our jurisdictional offer named all interested parties, the landlord and the tenant, and it advised that you can get 32.19 relocation payments under 32.20, quote, if shown to exist, close quote. Under sub 7 of 3205, we issued an award because the landowner did not accept our jurisdictional offer. When we issued the award, we named all interested parties, the landlord, Roadster, and the tenant, Coakley. And we recorded the award in the Milwaukee County Register of Deeds office on January 30th, 2002. Under the statutes, particularly sub 7, that was the date of taking, January 30th, 2002. That is the date that the City of Milwaukee acquired fee simple absolute title. That is the date that the City of Milwaukee owned the property that it paid for. That is the date that terminated the oral lease between Coakley and its landlord, Roadster. There was no more lease because eminent domain in a total taking, such as was the case here, terminates the lease. Now, when the City of Milwaukee took the property lawfully by eminent domain and filed that award, 32.05 sub 7 provides that we pay the award into court. Now, when we pay the award into court,
if I can back up just a moment, Mr. Hagopian, because you just made the argument when the city took the property lawfully. I'm looking under 32.05.8c. The condemner may not require the persons who occupied the premises on the date the title vested in the condemnor to vacate until a comparable replacement property is made available. And as I understand opposing counsel's argument, that never occurred. So when that doesn't occur, what happens, and has the city lawfully taken possession?
There is no challenge to the taking here. There is a stipulation to the effect that all jurisdictional requirements to the taking were done. The city owns fee simple title to that property, and there was no challenge to the taking. Moreover, there's a different statute of limitations that applies to the challenge to taking, and that statute of limitations has long since passed. So the city of Milwaukee is the lawful fee simple owner.
So what happens if one of the requisites of 3205 is to make a comparable replacement property available, and that has not occurred? What is the effect of that, and what is supposed to take place under the statutes?
Normally, what would happen is the city is in ownership, and there is somebody on its property,
squatting,
an occupant. They're lease terminated by virtue of the eminent domain. They are just there as an occupant. That's where we get into the Dottie case. That's where we get into the Midwest II case. What is supposed to happen when the parties are in agreement about the occupant being a, quote, displaced person, close quote, described under 32.19, is the city should be approaching that occupant to say, we need to identify for you a comparable replacement property, which is also, in this situation, a comparable replacement business, i.e., a different parking lot. You might not be able to afford it. We don't have to pay for it. We don't have to go out and get it and give it to you. All we have to do is identify it. It's on the market. It meets the comparable replacement business definition under 32.19 and therefore is a 32.05 sub 8 comparable replacement property. And once we've done that, we've satisfied that element, which is a precondition to ouster. And then we are entitled to oust. We didn't have to oust here. Well, we did have to oust. And when we did oust, the tenant vacated. Once the tenant vacated, ousters became moot. The Roadster case became moot.
Well, Counselor, you're not suggesting that the tenant should not have gotten out when the court ordered the tenant off the property, are you?
No, what I'm suggesting is that the tenant could have availed itself of significant statutory protections, which the tenant failed to do.
What? What statutory protections?
I could go back into my overview.
You don't need to go in your overview. Just tell me what statutory.
All right, there are some statutory protections. For example, the tenant could have petitioned for an apportionment of the award. And when it would have petitioned for the apportionment of the award, it would have received dollars that otherwise went to the landlord. So they could have been paid.
But the award is just compensation, as you so aptly point out in your brief. It is not, the award is not relocation benefits. And he's asking for relocation benefits, so I don't see why petitioning to apportion the award has anything to do with relocation benefits.
In a situation where the tenant is not related to the landlord, the tenant could get a share of dollars. But let me be more focused in answer to your question. One of the things that Coakley could have done vis-a-vis relocation was obey the lawful order. Well, one of the things he could have done, as I believe Chief Justice Abramson mentioned, is dug its heel in. They could have stayed and said, look, we still disagree with you. We are a displaced person, and we disagree with the trial court. And we recognize that in Wisconsin, the trial court is not necessarily the last state.
Well, and they appealed. That's exactly what they did. And they couldn't have gotten an injunction because they'd have to say they had no other remedy at law, and they have an appeal.
That's what they're saying now. They have no other remedy at law because they left and we didn't identify a comparable replacement parcel.
Well, they left because the court ordered them off the property. And what I'm trying to understand here is why that was the wrong thing for them to do. And by doing that, it appears you're arguing they've given up all their benefits because then you got physical possession. And his argument is, hey, we were just following the court's order. You may have gotten physical possession, but that's not what the statute meant because then you'd have to disconnect that term in that statute from all the other benefits that we were supposed to
have been provided but didn't get because the trial court looked at our status incorrectly, which the Court of Appeals pointed out. So I'm having a hard time figuring out what they should have done, aside from disobeying a court order, which I certainly would not advise.
Well, it's one thing to disobey a court order. It's another thing to respectfully seek a stay pending appeal, which they did not do, and they could have done.
Okay.
And they could have said that we have irreparable harm because if we vacate, then preconditions to ouster become moot. So that's irreparable harm. We can't vacate. We have irreparable harm. We need an injunction. We need a protective order. We need a stay pending appeal. They didn't do that.
But there's no case law that says what you're telling us now. That's why you're before us. Right?
Well,
so they would have to persuade the trial court in the same way that you're trying to persuade us that the trial court was wrong and should, or they could apply to the Court of Appeals if the trial court denied it. Okay, I think I understand.
What I'm saying is that was one available alternative. They had other alternatives, several arrows in the quiver they could have used. The other available alternative is they could have fully accepted the trial court order. They didn't even have to appeal it. They could have then gone and filed a 3220 claim, as one would have expected. Now, when they did go to Roadster, they were litigating over what the definition of 32.19 is. If they would have gone one section down in the statute books, they would have found 3220. They could have filed a claim with the condemnor saying, look, we left the property. We maintain that we are a displaced person, and we are entitled to relocation payments.
The trial court had found they were not a displaced person. The city's not going to pay them for something the city didn't think they were to begin with, and the trial court said, city, you're right.
They could appeal from the denial of the 3220 claim. Another thing they could have done is, let's say that we never moved for a writ to oust them.
Well, but you did move for a writ to oust them.
Okay,
if
we did.
If they'd left voluntarily, I think we wouldn't be having this discussion.
One of the things they could have done is they could have looked under 32.25 and they could have looked under 32.26. Under 32.26 sub 5, Coakley could have availed itself of some of those statutory protections. They could have petitioned the State Department of Commerce saying that they were dissatisfied with how they were being treated by the condemnor over relocation assistance. They could have demanded an investigation by the Department of Commerce.
Counselor, doesn't relocation assistance go to someone who is a displaced person? Isn't that a criteria they had to meet before they had any rights to relocation assistance?
Well, and I believe they went halfway when they brought the case leading to the Roadster decision.
I know, but my question to you is just a simpler question. Don't they first have to be a displaced person before they have any right to these statutory benefits?
They do.
And the circuit court said, nope, Coakley, you're not a displaced person. So that's the end of the story, right?
But it wasn't here because they appealed and prevailed.
Okay, and that's right. They did appeal, and they did prevail on that appeal.
Now, when they appealed, knowing that they still disagreed with us over their definition status as a displaced person, they should have also filed a protective 3220 claim rather than an 89380 claim. An 89380 claim is very much the wrong procedure. I believe it's the Nesbitt Farms case coupled with the Rotter case coupled with Gorski. That shows, even Dottie, that 3220 is the only way to go. An 89380 is the wrong claim. So what they could have done when they were litigating over their definitional status is they should have also protected itself by filing a 3220 claim and preserving its rights. They could have also protected itself by demanding an investigation of the Department of Commerce under 32.26. And the Department of Commerce oversees condemnation and relocation, and they could have investigated, and they could have even brought in, the Department of Commerce could have brought in the State Attorney General to help prosecute the City of Milwaukee
think they would have done that when the trial courts already said they're not a displaced person?
I don't see why not, because they didn't agree with the trial court. And when you don't agree with the trial court...
I'm just talking about these other agencies of the state. Do you think they're really going to get involved in this when you've got a decision by a trial court that says, hey, folks, you're not entitled to this benefit, that they're going to do an investigation contrary to that order?
I can't speak for the Department of Commerce. However, I could surmise that the Department of Commerce would realize that there is an appeal and that they had a petition in front of it from Coakley. Had they availed themselves of that opportunity, they couldn't ignore that petition. They'd have to make some finding on a petition if Coakley would have used that protection.
Would that second action stay the running of the 2-year statute of limitations that you've raised here?
No. It would have, because had Coakley availed itself of that 3226 protection and filed a 3220 claim within the time period that the plain language of 3220 requires, they would have been protected. Coakley was not protected because they filed late the wrong type claim seeking general damages not recognized under Chapter 32. They knew that they had to file a claim, but they didn't file the right claim. They didn't file it for the right damages, and they didn't file it on the right time.
Well, let's just look at that for 1 second. First of all, if you told me I forgot or didn't hear it, was Coakley a party in City of Milwaukee versus Roadster?
Yes, it was.
Two. 3220 says claims for damages itemized in 3219 and 32195. Those are claims we're talking about here?
But they have to be itemized and recognized under 3219 and 32.195. No, not the claims that were made against us. Only one of them in the second amended complaint had some bearing.
So in this action, you don't think they have filed under 3219 and 32195?
Oh, I know that they didn't file a 3220 claim, and I know they didn't make the offer of proof required under 3219.
Okay. Suppose they had. Let's just suppose. How do they do that? The claims shall be filed with the condemnor. How do you file a claim with the city? That's the condemnor here, how?
You go to the city of Milwaukee and file a claim with the city clerk under 3220.
Okay, do you have to fit, you don't have to fit under 89380, is that the statute that says how you file claims against government bodies? Is that your position?
89380 has a provision in the statute itself.
Yeah.
Which is sub 5, that says when rights or remedies are provided by any other statute against a political corporation or government subdivision like the city of Milwaukee, such statute shall apply. So basically what 89380 is telling us and what the legislature is telling us is when there's a specific statute on claims, like there is in 3220, follow that, not 89380. Moreover...
And you say our cases say that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
There's a Nesbitt case, Court of Appeals 2003, that says 89380 is not applicable to eminent domain. And the Rotter case is a 1976 Supreme Court case that says failure to timely file a 3220 claim extinguishes the right to recover relocation benefits. So 89380 was clearly the wrong type claim.
And they followed 89380 in this case?
Yes.
Okay. Then it says all such claims must be filed after the damages upon which they are based. So the damages upon which they are based, you say, should have been relocation damages. Is that right?
Absolutely, because it's well-established case law that 3205 sub 8 doesn't establish any independent damage rights or claims, which were the questions that Justices Butler and Ziegler, I believe, were alluding to.
Okay. And then it says, upon which they are based, have fully materialized. What the devil does fully materialize, and do I care when I interpret?
Oh, you absolutely care, because...
Okay.
In the Midwest,
I thought I didn't care because it says not later than 2 years. years, so I don't think I care. Why do you think I should care?
Well, you should definitely care because, first of all, in the Dottie case, okay, when the city of Madison tendered the maximum amount of relocation benefit, it didn't tender it to the occupant. It tendered it to the court with the proviso that it would be paid out so long as the occupant met the requirements for payout under 32.19. Moreover, in the Midwest 2 case, there is a paragraph that says that really it gets to the notion that eligibility for relocation payments, i.e. the Roadster case, i.e. being defined as a displaced person, does not equal entitlement to relocation payments. Because even though you might be eligible as a displaced person, you still need to be entitled. You still have to bring yourself within, it's Midwest 2 paragraph 37, you still have to bring yourself within the specific statutory relocation law 32.19 and meet the requirements therein in order to actually get the money from the city. Now, as a precondition to ouster, the city identifies, but the city doesn't pay relocation payments. That's the misquote in Midwest 2 paragraph 23 that needs to be fixed. The city only pays out under 32.19 when the occupant displaced person comes forward and proves that they have fully materialized claims that are cognizable under 32.19 and that they are entitled to payment. In this case, Coakley would have come to the city, filed a 3220 claim, not 89380, within the 2-year period that the plain language of the statute requires. They would have had to have said, we found other place. We rented it or we bought it. Here is what we paid or here is what we rented it for. Let's say they would have rented 17 other spaces. Under 32.19 sub 4M, Coakley doesn't automatically get $30,000. They just get the rent differential between whatever they were paying Roadster and the rent that they pay at their new location times 48 months.
Counselor, your yellow light is on, and I gave your opposing counsel a statute and asked him to look at it. And you know, it may have absolutely nothing to do with this case at all, but it's 89313 sub 1 and sub 2. And over the top reading, it appears that when there is a case that is appealed, the statute of limitations that might apply to an issue in that case could possibly be told until the case is dismissed. And my concern focuses on whether the 2-year statute of limitations, which you're relying on to bar Coakley's suit here, is told by the first Roadster Coakley case until the circuit court dismissed that case. Does that statute have anything to do with what we're doing here? Because it says a law limiting the time for the commencement of an action is told. And I want you to, you know, you may not have had a chance to think about it, and that's fair, just to say I didn't consider it. But if you have considered it and you don't think it applies, if you would tell me, that would be great.
The statute does not apply.
Okay, tell me why.
The reason why it doesn't apply is because the more specific chapter, 32, controls over 893.
Where does Chapter 32 talk about tolling the statute of limitations for a time that's set by the statute?
It doesn't, nor does the Rotter Supreme Court case that says if that plain 2-year limit with physical possession is not met, the displaced person's rights are extinguished, period. There is no tolling under 893.13 or the Rotter case.
Does the Rotter case mention 89313?
No. But the more specific statute here would control, and Rotter would control, and
only
it makes sense.
Only if the issue was raised. I mean, you folks didn't argue to us, and as I said, it may have nothing to do with it, but it obviously bothers me, and maybe it was never raised in Rotter either.
The non-applicability of 893.13 also makes sense when you consider Chapter 32 and harmonize it, and 32's provisions, under Chapter 32, this is government action, government budgets, government needs finality, and as the Midwest II case recognized, government cannot have eminent domain cases hold up public projects, because after all, we're dealing with eminent domain and public projects where the private individual's interest has to give way to the public. The public projects cannot be upheld forever or for however long eminent domain litigation might take place before the government can budget with its annual budgeting process a contingency or appropriation for payout for just compensation or payout for the capped relocation benefits in Chapter 32.
Is this anything that you thought about before I asked you about it?
I've thought certainly very much about Chapter 32 and the importance of all the timelines therein and why within Chapter 32...
I'm just wanting to know if you had thought about 8, 9,
no, I did not.
Okay, thank you. That's fine. That's fair.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Hagopian, I do have one question that has kind of confused me a bit, and I'm not quite sure what the answer is. I understand the claim, the city's argument about statute of limitations precludes this particular action. But I'm looking at paragraph 19 of the Roadster decision. And I'll just read it if it'll make it easier. For the foregoing reasons, Copley was not excluded from the status of a displaced person and therefore is entitled to a comparable replacement property before the writ for restitution may be ordered. Now, am I missing something, or why isn't it part of the Roadster case and part of the order of the Court of Appeals, and in order to make that case final, that those steps should have occurred as part of that action? Am I missing something here?
No, I think the questions previously raised by the justices reflect the fact that this case was dismissed on remand. And once again, our position would be that the tenant didn't avail itself of protections available either within the law of the case itself, under the common law, or under the statutes.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Ziegler.
But nor did the city avail itself of getting the writ of assistance properly so that possession of the property was properly obtained.
I believe that at the time this decision came out, McKinley Boulevard already existed on the parking lot and vehicular traffic was flowing on that parcel. So like the trial court, and I believe the Court of Appeals said in this case that once this decision was issued, it was of little to no importance.
Well, except that the rule of law then would be if the city or a governmental body goes in and takes property, even if they're wrong and they don't do it the right way, that, you know, once that's done, that starts the clock ticking 2 years and the city really doesn't have to get the writ of assistance the right way.
I see what you're saying. And like I said, the city of Milwaukee definitely takes eminent domain law very seriously. Coakley had 2 years in which to file a claim. Now, in Coakley's complaint, they allege that one of its generalized damages not recognized under Chapter 3219 was increased wages to reimburse their employees for parking. Well, really, they found alternative parking. They must have. Coakley could have, would have, should have filed a 3220 claim, but didn't, is really what it comes down to, and they had 2 years to do it.
Coakley have filed under 3220 in this Roadster case?
Coakley should have taken Roadster further by saying, not only are we a displaced person, but we are a displaced person entitled to relocation payments, and this is what we'd like the city of Milwaukee to do. There is no requirement under this case that the city really take any action, and the case was dismissed. So the case didn't go far enough. And that's why I've indicated in my brief to this court that it's really a moot advisory opinion.
Well, the paragraph 19 of the Court of Appeals and Roadster said, for the foregoing reasons, I'm looking at Plaintiff's Appendix 186, Coakley was not excluded as a displaced person and therefore is entitled to a comparable replacement property before the writ of for restitution may be ordered, and it was remanded for that purpose. Well, maybe it wasn't remanded for that purpose. It just said order reversed. What was the order? Final order granting a writ of assistance. So the writ of assistance was reversed, but nothing said about what they're entitled to.
Nothing said, nothing ordered. I can tell you that prior, after
said,
this...
Nothing ordered, and 3220 says, deals with when you took possession, doesn't it? It said...
Physical possession.
Physical possession, which has...
Plain, unambiguous language.
Which could be writ, illegal writ, voluntary, or whatever. That's your position.
Yes. Also, after this Roadster decision, and very importantly, prior to the 3220 deadline, the City of Milwaukee was in negotiations with Coakley. We did have a relocation specialist with whom, I believe the record reflects, met with Coakley, and we did offer the maximum $30,000 payment, even though Coakley had it followed the 3220 claim process, really would have only been entitled to rent differential for 48 months, which could have been, depending what their rent was at the old place and the new place, much less than $30,000. So it's not like the city took no action. We offered the maximum, and it was not accepted.
Does Coakley...
Justice Prosser.
Does Coakley or someone like Coakley have to do anything in order to become eligible for the identification of a comparable replacement property?
Well, one of the things that struck me when my colleague was speaking here was the impression that the displaced person can sit back and wait for a menu of choices to be provided and then select or not select from the menu. That's one way to approach it. Another way to approach it is for the tenant or displaced person to also look around and try to find 17 other parking places for its employees. But the direct answer to your question is yes, they do have to do something. They have to avail itself of the statutory protections that the legislature afforded. And if it disagrees with the condemnor, it's incumbent upon the displaced person to file a 3220 claim within the clear deadline that the plain language of 3220 sets. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Byrne?
I did have the opportunity, Justice Rogan-Sack, to take a look at 893.13 sub 1 and 2. I'll take a stab at it, although I had a brief chance. I do think it's applicable. I think the statute is not told until we've exhausted our appeal rights. More interestingly, though,
which
I'm looking at...
Which appeal rights, counsel?
Pardon me?
Which appeal rights?
Well, sub 2 says that a law limiting the time for commencement of an action is told by the commencement of the action to enforce the cause of action to which the period of limitation applies.
What should you have appealed? That's another way of my asking the question. What should you have appealed?
We should have appealed the decision of Judge Franke not allowing us relocation benefits. I believe that
which
since
the... Which decision is that?
That would be the second decision, which was our filing of our request for relocation benefits after the Roadster decision. The Roadster decision was after the successful appeal was dismissed without prejudice. And we entered into negotiations
right.
with the
so
city.
Right, so your position is you should have appealed the Roadster decision? I just want to know what the appeal was from.
No, the Roadster decision, in my opinion, gave very clear direction that the city should give us comparable replacement property.
Right.
That's my
You had position. Nothing to, you couldn't appeal because it was in your favor.
Correct.
All right. So what told it? I just have to know what told it.
Filing of the appeal and or the filing of the of our cause of action with Judge Franke.
That this case that you
Correct.
Talking? So you're saying that this case told the statute? I mean, the issue in this case is, did you file outside the statute?
If you take that statute applies, again, I'm a little bit shooting from the hip to try to answer the question.
That's
one of the
right.
interesting things
Sorry.
I came across in 3220 is that we have to file a claim within 2 years.
Right.
We are allowed to file 90 days thereafter if our claim's denied a cause of action, but there's no end point to that. Again, I haven't looked at this fully, but I believe that gives us then 6 years to file suit for relocation benefits if our claim's denied. That's kind of an interesting issue that jumps up here in going through this because the filing of the claim, I also believe in looking at Nesbitt and Rotter speaks to the proposition that in those cases, in Nesbitt, it said you don't have to file a notice of claim before you can file suit on relocation benefits. The defense there was that the municipality said you have to file a notice of claim before you can sue us for relocation benefits. The court said no, there's a procedure in 32. To do that, and Rotter said you don't have to file separate claims. They have to go through the commission. You don't have to file, if you believe you get an excess, you don't file separate claims. 32 is the narrow avenue for where your claims are available. I think the city has made my point in terms of comments to Chief Justice Abramson and the statement to the effect that, yes, when we get physical possession, no matter how we get it, that extinguishes the rights of the displaced person to receive their relocation benefits. I don't think that's what the legislature had in mind. I believe that ambiguity, and I'll liken it to, although I don't think it's stealing, it's to the little boy who walks out of the store with the candy bar and eats it and is standing with the candy wrapper and said, after someone says you need to pay for it, they said, well, I ate it already.
Counsel.
But that action hasn't taken place and the candy bar is gone. That doesn't mean that value hasn't been taken, and the legislature anticipated that we should get something for what has occurred, in my opinion.
With regard to 3220, I'm looking at the words of the statute. So you would want us to put in before the words physical possession, you want us to insert the word legal physical possession. Is that correct?
I don't see this any different than the Hansen-Robbins case where this court interpreted what accrue meant. I think physical possession and reading these statutes together, the court...
Sorry. Okay. Testing the alarm. I was supposed to have warned you, but I became so engrossed that I forgot. Sorry about that.
Your clerk was kind enough, Chief Justice, to let us know that was going to happen.
Well, she warned me, too, but it didn't stop me from jumping.
She also had her fingers over her ears just before it started.
Well, I was too engrossed to notice all that. Okay, can we talk over that?
Yes, I'm trying to remember what brilliant statement I was about to make, Chief Justice.
My question was, you want us to insert the word legal before the words physical possession in 32.20. Is that correct?
That's correct. I believe in reading the statutes together, that would give a reasonable reading of the statute. I do not believe the legislature anticipated in stating physical possession that meant that it would abrogate the obligation of the condemnor to jump through the hoops that they needed to in 3205 sub 8 to gain possession. I draw a distinction.
Just a minute. Is there any other place in 3220 that you want us to insert a word, or is that the only one?
That's the only place that I think it's necessary to define what physical possession was meant. And I believe that I draw a distinction. I'm drawing a distinction between ownership of property and possession. Similar to, you can't oust a tenant from legal possession without taking proper legal steps. Ownership is different. The fact that the city owned the property through the condemnation process is different than what they need to do to take a displaced person out of possession.
Counsel, I want to follow up a question that Justice Prosser asked right at the beginning of the argument. I'm looking at the decision of the Roadster case, and obviously I have some concerns about paragraph 19. But as I understand the Roadster decision, that matter was remitted back from this court on August 13th of 2003. This action was filed on September 29th of 2005. Now, if we accept the city's position that the action would have to be filed under Chapter 32, then Justice Prosser's question, I think, is a good one. Why doesn't the statute, two-year statute of limitations apply, even if we toll the statute during the pendency of the appeal in the Roadster case?
Well, and it's an interesting question, and I wish that I had thought that it was germane to the issue, and I apologize that it wasn't properly briefed. It's interesting because in reading it, 3220 requires that a claim be filed. It then gives you 90 days if that claim is denied to file suit. So it's really very interesting because you need to file the claim first, and then a cause of action accrues thereafter. I think that even strengthens my position that this isn't really this is a limitation to sue a municipality, but it isn't really a statute of limitation to file suit because we didn't even have the opportunity to file a claim. I think Justice Rogensack was asking the question, I believe, about, well, why would the city even accept a claim from us if they didn't believe you were a displaced person? So we wouldn't even have an opportunity to file a claim, giving rise to us even having the right to walk into court and file a cause of action. So I don't even know if there is interplay between. I'm really shooting from the hip at that issue and in reading 3220 and trying to understand as I read through that, and I thought it's the first time it raised in my mind. It says 2 years to file a claim. If your claim is denied, then 90 days to file in circuit court. I saw no, through my brief review of 32, no limitation therein to filing a claim for relocation benefits. There may be one in the COM regulations. I don't know that. But if there isn't, then it would be 6 years, similar to 89380 claim.
Thank you.
I have the red light, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes our hearing in Coakley Relocation Systems versus City of Milwaukee, 2006, AP 2292. I want to thank Attorney Mearn and Attorney Hagopian for their arguments this morning on yet another relocation case. We will take a brief recess because these students may leave and others may come. We are in